It's time for Type 40, your Doctor Who podcast on the Fandom Podcast Network. It's the show where we take an in-depth and closer look at this beloved television series, the spin-offs and even the merchandising. Doctor Who's a global fandom phenomenon that has shaped the landscape of science fiction and fantasy for well over five decades. So step into our TARDIS, share our journey together here on Type 40. Welcome. Yes, out we pop, out from the Matrix for more Doctor Who talk to scratch that geeky itch for the next hour or so with an all-black country edition of Type 40. What does he mean? What's he talking about? Stay tuned, all will be revealed. I'm Dan Hadley, your regular Type 40 pilot, Birmingham's true king of the geeks. Most crucially, though, I'm a lifelong Doctor Who fan, as maybe you are. But maybe not. Wherever and whenever you join the Doctor's Travels and whatever grade of fan you class yourself, everybody's welcome. There's no gatekeeping here, only conversation, fun and games. And this time, yes, those frequently asked questions that we have as part of the Type 40 stable. I shuffle through the times and places of another fellow Doctor Who fan. Game to come and blow away some cobwebs with me. And this time we've got a new voice to the show, though a guy I'm expecting some of you may have heard. He's one of the Led Zepp of Doctor Who fandom, aboard the long-running podcast Proctor Who, all the way from Wolverhampton, Mr. Suki Kark. Hello, Suki.
Hello, Dan. How are you?
I've got that right, isn't it? It's Wolverhampton, or have we got certain borders?
It's Wolverhampton, yes. It's very close. I mean, we're both Wars of Fenric alumni, so yes, very close.
That's right. I did wonder, because people do get quite picky, don't they, about the boundaries between the Black Country and the rest of the Midlands in the UK.
No, I'm not that fussed. I don't care. Right. If they say Black Country, that could mean Wensbury, that could mean Darlow, that could mean Bilston, that could mean Willenor. I don't care. It's just Black Country.
Yeah, yeah. But the one thing that does that unites us, place of origin, it's the also famous for Peaky Blinders now. I find that that's sort of tuning in people to the Black Country in Birmingham in generally, internationally.
Right. Do you watch Peaky Blinders?
I do watch Peaky Blinders, but I am about 3 years behind the rest of the world.
Okay. Well, in that case, I'll get in touch with you later. You can tell me what the heck's going on, because I've never watched an episode. So you're barking up the wrong tree with me there, man.
Yeah, I'm a little bit behind with it. It's yeah, we'll talk some more about Peaky Blinders. But yeah, you're with Proctor Who.
Yes.
And do you want to tell us a little bit about that, what that is and where you came in with that?
Right, Proctor Who, that's been a Doctor Who podcast that's been running now for about 5 years. And it started off by Mark Atkinson and Bob Fleming. And then they were slowly joined by Craig Stimson. And they've been running together for a while, for about 3 or 4 years. And then Bob decided he was going to leave. And he left. So Mark, yes, shock horror. And then Mark decided that he together with Craig that they were going to get guest hosts on for each episode. And they sort of decided to put my name forward, and I said, yeah, I'll come on. You know, and they said, great, fantastic. So I did an episode with them, and I really enjoyed myself. And then heard that they were going to WarpCon, and I thought, okay, I'll meet up with the guys there. Because WarpCon was a convention up in Manchester, a one-day convention. And I went up there, and I met Craig, and I met Mark, and Bob was there as well. So all four of us had a chin wag. We got a photo, fantastic photo, which I've got pride of place down here, with me, Peter Davison, Colin Baker, Paul McGann. And there's all four of us are in that photo with them guys. It's a great photo. And at the end of the night, there was a party, an after show party, an after con party, you'd like to say. And we were sitting there, and the room was virtually empty because most of the people weren't staying in Manchester. They'd gone. And there was like half a dozen people in the room. They did a quiz. It was just boring. But the lads were slowly getting drunk. And I was sitting there with my cow. Right? Because I don't drink. So what am I going to do? I was just sitting there with my cow. So the lads were slowly getting drunk. And halfway through this drunken talking to each other, Bob turns around. And he'd left the podcast by this time. And he turned around and goes, do you fancy joining the podcast? I said, yeah, why not? I'll join it. Yeah. If you know, you're not going to be in it. So I don't mind being the third. No. He goes, I'm going to be back. I thought, no, you've just left. How can you be back? He said, no, I'm coming back as well. But so Bob came back. I joined on full time. And we started doing Proctor Who for a few months. And then Bob decided he was going to do a Discovery podcast, which is great. Star Trek Discovery. I follow the first one.
Oh, yeah.
Right. I mean, if you've, you, you've probably watched Star Trek Discovery, and it's great, the first season. And we then decided for the second season, we'll get some people on and get and a guest host on that. And it was going to be me and Bob and a guest host. But then all of a sudden, Bob couldn't do it. And other things got in the way. And so he brought on a guest host called John Aiken. And John and myself have become close. John is fantastic, great podcaster. So that when we just finished Discovery, we decided to carry on together and do Take Your Seats podcast.
You couldn't bear not podcasting together while Discovery was off air. That's what it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was it.
The bromance had started.
The bromance hadn't finished. He just carried on and carried on. And John has been fantastic, right? And I do all the behind-the-scenes stuff, getting people to come on. John will do all the questions, and I'll just chip in with my comments. But again, Take Your Seats podcast is just somebody comes on with their favourite movie and we'll discuss it for half an hour to about an hour. And it's a great little format. And we have got people that have gone from really obscure films to great big blockbusters. I mean, we've had Dark Star, which is a John Carpenter film, which is terrible, but it's good.
First one, wasn't it?
And then we had Planet Nine from Outer Space, which is absolutely crap. But watching it, right, it's fantastic, and you just carry, you just get sucked into how bad it is, and you carry on watching it. And then we've gone all the way up to Dan wanted to do this, by the way, didn't you, Dan? You wanted to do Star Wars,
but I did want to do Star Wars.
Yeah. And we are going to be recording the Star Wars episode today. Dan has happily for us, he's going to come on later on in next year, right, to come on to do the sequel, Empire Strikes Back. Aren't you, mate?
I am. I'm very much looking forward to it, in fact. And to be honest, you know, a fate may well have sort of intervened there with the other film for reasons to be disclosed at a later date in the new year. I won't give it all away just yet. But yeah, I am thrilled to be invited onto the show. Take Your Seats is a great show. How can I put this? I'm a little bit behind with it at the time, but the eclectic nature of the films within the genre and the conversation that you have, it's superb. And Proctor Who too, I mean, that's kind of, it's sort of like the whistle test of Doctor Who podcasts, isn't it? It's got that kind of whispering feel to it.
All right.
You know, so I'm hoping, you know, John Aitken obviously is wonderful, and Mark and Craig, you know, hoping to coax the boys on at some point.
Well,
you know,
I'm sure they'll all come on. They'd love to come
put
on.
Put the bait, yeah. Because I feel like I know you all just in a short period of listening. They are they're fantastic shows. And, you know, even the truth is, although we know of each other, we don't know each other, do we? There was the Wharves of Fenric Doctor Who group, as you mentioned earlier on, back in the day. We're going back 25, 30 years, aren't we, here?
Yes.
This local group that was based in Wolverhampton. And Roger Clark, hello, Roger, if you're listening.
Hello, Roger.
Who was the main sort of the captain of that particular ship. But yeah, it's all these links back to an earlier time of Doctor Who fandom, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
And yeah, so all your shows, we're gonna put links to them in the show notes after, so people can find if they want to hear a little bit more of you. Not that you need the help. I know the podcasts are doing really, really well. One of the things about podcasting, and you know, we've spoken a little bit about this before, but things that we both enjoy is getting to know people. A one-way thing through your ears or over the mic, the way we're doing today. It's sort of like a public bonding experience, isn't it? So,
yeah. I mean,
but go on, sorry.
I was just going to say, you're right about meeting people. I wouldn't get to meet some of the people that I have met. I mean, if I decide I'm going to put myself forward for that Proctor episode, that initial very first guest I was in, I wouldn't have met Mark, Craig and Bob, right? And that has been one of the best experiences I've had, right? And they're great to talk to. If you didn't have these sort of people to be able to be on the other end of a conversation, right, you're just going to be floundering. I would be floundering, I should say, right? But with these people, they bring out certain elements of your conversational skills, and the podcast just comes alive. And this is what it is with these three guys and with John on Take Your Seats.
Yeah, a conversation between equals, between friends, just shared and put out there simply to amuse and to entertain. It is that simple.
We'll take the pee out of each other, obviously.
You do. And, you know, listeners, you know, the feedback that we get is that people do feel part of it. I mean, there's a question I've been dying to ask you, for example, as a prog man, as a Doctor Who fan. The most obvious question really is, who would make the best Davros? Is it Peter Gabriel or Phil Collins?
Hold on. You're asking the wrong person out of the team about music question. Rob, if you listen, you know, you listen to it. I don't actually pick any of the music. not amusing. Although this is something that I have not told any, I haven't mentioned on the in the intro to Proctor Who, is Proctor Who is a music-based Doctor Who podcast. The other guys will pick songs to play during the year of the podcast. So we usually it's about 3 to 4 songs each episode, and there could be prog rock, there could be pop music, which what Craig loves. They have been known to be stuff that Mark's written, because Mark is a singer-songwriter.
I've heard it.
And just let you know, he's just got a new album out called Moon Halo, and that should be out 9th of December. No, not 9th of December. 9th of January, but it's been pre-released now. So if you go to... I'm plugging on your show, mate. Sorry, mate.
That's okay.
just, guys, now, if you want to listen to any of Mark's music, just go to the Proctor Who website or to Mark Atkinson, Moon Halo Appreciation Society on Facebook, and you get all the links for Mark's music.
Mark, he's going to want a cut for this. You do realise that, don't you?
I don't know.
It's great stuff. I've heard some of the tracks already. It's beautiful stuff. It's very, very accomplished singer and songwriter and musician, isn't he, Mark?
Bob's also got his own band. I don't think he's released anything as yet. Craig has never released anything. But from there, as I said,
I'm sure he's hiding his light under a bushel there somewhere.
I think it's more like the other guys while letting play anything on the podcast.
Enough about those clowns. We're gonna dig deep. We're gonna talk about what made you a fan, really, the magic of Doctor Who, and no doubt we'll go on plenty of other tangents along the way. But whilst we chat, we're gonna offer you some snacks. We always offer some snacks. We break out the biscuit barrel and everything. So what snacks would you rather go for? The Jammy Dodgers, as favoured by the 11th Doctor. Custard creams, which the current Doctor, she keeps the TARDIS loaded with those. Or one of the 6th Doctor's nut roast rolls. Which of those do you fancy?
I prefer custard creams, but if they were bourbon...
Well, here you go. It's nice. There you go. Just have as many as you like, because they go soft, if you believe them out.
I'll stuff your face quite happily while you're chin wagging. That's not a problem.
You open those. I need to run through a few of our what we call our essential fix points that we must remind our companions of as part of the Fandom Podcast Network. You can find each and every edition of our show, past, present and future, on the FPNet master feed at fpnet.podbean.com and FPNet on the Podbean app. That's really easy to use. Love the Podbean app. The Fandom Podcast Network's also on Spotify, Stitcher and Google Play, as well as Apple Podcasts, which is the app formerly known as iTunes, of course. Search for us there, add us and share us if you're feeling really brave. There's our social media presence, Instagram and Twitter, Type 40 Doctor Who, the Type 40 Facebook group. It's all lively and inclusive and growing by the week. We sincerely appreciate all our members there. You'd like them, Sookie? Some of them, maybe?
Some of them.
But there's links to all of that in the show notes too. Sookie, are you a snapper, a grammar or a tweeter? Where can people find you?
Well, I'm basically on Twitter quite a lot of the time. I've got an Instagram, but if you go onto Twitter, you'll find me under Cyberman_151. And then also, if you follow the Proctor Who feed, that's also on there. And again, you just look up Proctor Who on Twitter. And the other podcast feed that we've got is Take Your Seats Podcast, and that goes under Take Your Seats P. Through Facebook, a lot of that is through the Proctor Who Facebook page. So just Google, just search Proctor Who on the Facebook, and you'll see us on there.
Yeah. Can't miss it. It's a superb logo. It's unmistakable what you've got there. And you can find me on Instagram and Twitter as The Spacebook, where I talk about all things outside of the TARDIS in movies and TV, comic books, playing old geeking out, and doing so daily in the Spacebook Facebook group. Come and find us all. Come and have a chat. Sookie, would you say that we talked about your colleagues there? Would you say you're the cheerful one, I think, aren't you?
No. Craig has always been the cheerful one. I'm more along the scales of Craig, but Craig is a lot more cheerful than I am. You know, you can get just listen to Craig and you get so happy just listening to him, basically. So Craig's the cheerful one.
Well, this is it. I mean, getting to know somebody. There are a few gaps in your Matrix bio data here, so I'm going to try and fill some of those in with the Type 40 list of frequently asked questions. If you've not heard any of these before, these are those things that get fired our way, both by one another as Doctor Who fans when we meet like this, or even by members of our family or new friends as we have conversations and inevitably, as Doctor Who fans, fans, we try and sort of steer the conversation somewhere in the direction of Doctor Who, somewhere down the line. So these questions always come up. But yeah, let's start with the simplest of them all. How or when did you first become aware of something called Doctor Who?
Right. See, the TV show I wasn't really aware of, not for many years. I used to read the books. I might have been aware of it on the television, but it was the Target books that really got me into it. So I'd go to Bilson Library and I'd pick up a book and I'd just read it, and I'd be able to finish it within a couple of days and then take it back to the library.
And you didn't even know there was a TV show at that point. You just
I was reading these books when I was about six, seven, eight, 9 years old. Right. So by then, right, it's only a bit later on, I think I started watching it quite regularly from about Tom Baker's final season, so that'd be 1980. But before then, it was just the books, and I was into the books. I'd have to read the next book. And there used to be like a microfiche little system at Bilson Library, and I knew how to operate that. And even at that age, I'd find out when the next book was released, and I'd order it early. Now, the librarians there, they were lovely people. They understood that I was a bit of an obsessed child, and they'd order them for me. But more often than not, they'd just go, no, it's not coming through yet. You'd have to go to Wolverhampton. And because I was too young.
You knew what they were going to get in before they could possibly have.
Most of these librarians aren't going to be looking at the Doctor Who range. They're going to be looking at whatever Barbara McCartland was doing, or Mills and Boone. That's their generation. Jackie Collins, probably. That's what they were probably.
And elbow one another, the Doctor Who kids.
And they're probably. I'm walking through and they go, it's a flipping Doctor Who kid again. Right. So they'd let me order the books, but, you know, they knew that they wouldn't get them in for ages. So I used to carry on reading the books. And then it's only about, as it says, Tom Baker's era, that I've got really into. I saw the show, and then between Tom Baker's era and Peter Dow's era, they had the Five Faces of Doctor Who. Was it that? Yeah, it was Five Faces of Doctor Who. Where they showed previous Doctors, and some of these books had already been released by then, so I recognised it, and I thought, okay, brilliant. And then from Peter Dowson's era is when I started watching it regularly, and I think I only missed one episode during that time. And I think it's because I had a wedding party on that day. And that was the only time I ever missed an episode. After a few years, when I got my own video recorder, I ended up recording everything. I was watching it every day.
Sucker, you're bringing back a memory here that I kept buried. I tell everybody that I didn't miss a single episode live for all these years, but there was one for me as well, and that was down to somebody. Can you believe this? Somebody having the inconsiderate nature to book their wedding on the night that Doctor Who was on, and it was episode 3 of The Trial of a Time Lord. And I even know the date. It was Saturday, September the 27th, 1986. I had to miss Doctor Who. And I did time the VCR, and I tried to anticipate. You know the bumpers in between shows on the BBC where you'd got like the continuities and things? Yeah. I tried to anticipate, knowing that it may start a little bit later. And I did manage to get it fairly dead on for my videotape. But yeah, I've kept that at the back of my mind.
Well, this is you. Once you start watching a show and you miss an episode, you do become upset. And I remember getting upset at that. I'm trying to remember what episode.
Because
it was.
You didn't know if you were ever going to see it again. I mean, if you hadn't got a VCR at the time, you couldn't guarantee ever catching it.
Actually, I probably wouldn't have been that upset. I'm pretty sure it was the first episode of Time Flight. Right, so I probably was upset at the time, but in hindsight.
Eight of the four episodes of Time Flight, that's the one you don't want to miss.
Yeah, well, you just end up catching it later and think, what was all the fuss about?
Yeah. Do you remember what your very first episode was, or was it just sort of a gradual thing of Doctor Who coming sort of out of your blind spot gradually appearing?
I think the very first episode I can remember clearly watching was Leisure Hive, the first episode of that Tom Baker's final season. I remember watching that clearly. Then after that, it's intermittent because I ain't got my memory ain't brilliant, but I did watch all the episodes all the way through that season. I'm pretty sure I did. I've got a vague memory of Tom Baker going through some cloths into a hut. And I can't remember where that's from, but it might be Face of Evil. I've got no recollection of at all, but except for this little memory that I've got of Tom Baker rushing through these cloths.
So why did you keep watching? Was it a case of, you know, you read the books and once you found it, you weren't going to let it go? Or did you carry on watching to support the reading habit?
No, it's definitely a bit of both. But once you've got into the TV show and you understand the backstory of the Doctor, because by then there are all the reference books has also started coming out, The Making of Doctor Who, John Lefissier's guide program. The program guide had come out. And then it was only a couple of years later when the Celebration came out as well. And all these reference books were all coming out. And once you start reading them and you understand there was a lot of backstory,
you start to put together a timeline in your own head, don't you?
Start thinking about the future of the show, the past of the show, the Doctor's interactions with all his companions. Mm. And you just get into it. And it then becomes a bit of an obsession, carry on watching it, but a good obsession that you want to carry on.
People use the word like obsession. It's obsession with a small O, isn't it? And you, particularly.
Well, this is it with us Doctor Who fans. I'm sure it's probably the same with you. Once you've started watching summer, you get sucked in by the storylines and you just carry on watching it all the way through. Performances are great. The actors are great. But if the storylines catch your imagination, you will carry on watching it.
That specific blend that makes a story identifiably Doctor Who as opposed to any other, even fantasy show, there's a certain recipe to it, isn't there? And a certain wink and nudge at the audience and the whole sort of caper angle. And yet great drama as well, the fact that it can be sort of everything to everybody in a sense.
You could say all that's correct. But remember, when I did start watching as an obsession with a small O, there were cliffhangers. If you come to a cliffhanger and say Peter Davison's head's about to be chopped off, right? You want to know if he's going
to
survive.
You need to be there.
And you carry on watching it because of the cliffhangers. Well, not just because of the cliffhanger, but that the cliffhangers helped, and you'd be sucked into the storyline. The cliffhangers would go, oh, yeah, I've got to come back next week to be able to. Well, actually, not next week. 2 days later, to be able to watch.
2 days later, the Peter Davison stories. Yeah, or sometimes the next day.
Yeah.
Talking about seeing the Doctor sort of face all these various perils and bearing in mind that you came in through the books and probably sampling all different kinds of eras, this may give you a slightly different perspective on this next question. The whole idea, that there's already two variations of it, isn't there? So the question of who is your Doctor, who's the best Doctor, who is your favourite? There's this big myth that it's always the first person that you saw play the part. But being a reader first, I mean, I've never subscribed to that either. But being a reader first as well, this must throw it wide open for you. So who is your Doctor, Suki?
See, my Doctor, it could be anybody that I've just watched, basically. Right? Okay. I know it's a bit of a dodgy answer.
Yeah.
But when people used to ask me, I'd say it was Sylvester McCoy because I really did like his stories and I'd like his last two seasons were brilliant. Curse of Fenric, Remembrance of the Daleks, Ghostlight. All these stories were imaginative stories. They had this Doctor doing his dastardly, devious little things behind the scenes. And you had a fantastic companion in Ace. So I really enjoyed those two seasons. Now,
the dynamic of it.
Yeah, dynamic of it, the way the stories were told, and the Andrew Cartmell used, basically, those last two.
There's something about that hook, isn't it? There's something about that hook that once Sylvester sort of found that, it did come together. It did feel unique.
Yeah, well, this is it. I think in that first season, he was. I don't think he was couched as well as he could have been. It's only when he'd been in the role for a year and decided he really needed to do something different, so rather than being like a Patrick Troughton knockoff, basically, because that's what he was in that first year.
It was as if Andrew Cartmell, it was as if they sat down and worked out between them the things that Sylvester did naturally or the way that he connected with the material, what were his strengths, and brought those through.
I know what you're saying, but remember, Sylvester McCoy famously said, right, that he didn't like doing all the big speeches, right? So that's one of the reasons why he could say he was being enigmatic, in that he was given a lot of his stuff to Sylvester to say. Right, and he looked mysterious because he was trying to coax it out of her. Right, so that way he looked like he knew what he was doing. Right, so
it was a great flip, though, wasn't it? Yeah. It's genius in a sense, so simple.
Yeah, it was. And Andrew Cartmell and the writers took that idea of the Doctor there trying to coax Ace as a character to make her grow as a woman, like as a person, right, to be able to carry the story forward. And it was done through making Ace a little pupil for the Doctor to teach. And that's one of the reasons why I liked it, is because of that dynamic between them pair.
Because they'd done that before, hadn't they, with Leela to a certain extent, but it was still not explored perhaps in the way that either Louise Jameson or Tom Baker wanted to take it. With this, they were able to plot it a bit more, weren't they?
This is it. Spack on. That's it, Dan. Because they did plot it, they knew what the stories were. They said, see this, at this bit, part of the story is trying to teach you something. This bit is trying to teach you something. This other story is trying to... Right. And she was sort of growing as a character.
Could you relate to Ace as well? Which of the two did you relate to more, the Doctor or the Companions?
Well,
in that dynamic.
I didn't have to relate to the Doctor because the Doctor was so knowing, so clever, and he knew things. Whereas I probably would be with Ace's character in that she was learning and I was learning at the same time what she was learning. And so that's how the story progressed. That's how I would have progressed. So I would have probably more related to Ace's character than probably the Doctor during that era. I mean, going back to Louise Jameson, Louise Jameson's character wasn't really developed after that first season. She was just a woman, a savage with a knife, as it was, and she was trying to learn things. But by the next story, she was sort of back to where she was. Right?
Wasn't that
much progress. And I think I can understand why she decided she was going to leave after, what, a year and a half. There wasn't really much going for her to carry on.
I suppose the crossover as well between Philip Hinchcliffe and Graham Williams, she was caught a little bit between that, whereas here you'd got that continuity of Andrew Cartmell sitting down with both Sylvester and Sophie and them working on this dynamic together and charting this sort of soft line, really, where they could take it all and leave them all room to grow.
But going back to, they definitely grew. But going back to favourite Doctor, right? And I did say Sylvester McCoy is my favourite Doctor. It is.
Yeah.
But having with Proctor Who, we do watch old episodes and. And every time I watch an old episode of another Doctor, I just fall in love with that character. I mean, we've just done Aztecs.
Same for me. Yeah.
And Aztecs with William Hartnell is a fantastic story. I really have loved that. In the many versions that I've seen in VHS, off DVD, whatever, I've watched on dodgy DVD, on dodgy VHS, such as that as well, from back in the day. And these...
I remember that too.
So I've gone from... Every time I watch a different Doctor, I just think that's my favourite Doctor. Right, so next time, what are we doing? Matt Smith's story? I'll probably end up watching that and go, yep, that's my favourite Doctor. Next time after that, we might watch a Patrick Troughton. I'll just go, oh, Patrick Troughton, wasn't he brilliant? That's my favourite.
It doesn't make us fickle, does it? It just means that we've been very, very fortunate with our lead actors over the last 50-odd years.
We have been very fortunate with...
Spoiled. We've been spoiled. We've talked a little bit about Ace and Leela. So, getting round to the companions. Have you got a favourite, all-time favourite companion? Or beans of the fact that you can't even really pick a favourite Doctor. is picking from, like, literally dozens of companions. Is that next to an impossibility? Have you got a couple you want to throw me favourite ones?
I mean, if you get to know who, I've loved Donna. Right? She was a breath of fresh air. She wasn't a mopey... Yeah. Companion that followed the Doctor. She wasn't a companion that was in love with the Doctor. She was just...
She wasn't a puppy dog, was she?
She was just funny. She's caring. And she was totally different to what people were assuming a Catherine Tate character companion would have been. And after that whole year...
That's fair, yeah. Yeah, you're probably right, come to think of it.
Well, if you remember, when the Runaway Bride was first shown as a one-off character, she was quite mad. She's quite shouting in the Doctor's face. And people came round to her point of view. But then when she was announced as a companion, there was still a bit of a backlash because they're thinking it was going to be the same as Runaway Bride.
Yeah, people thought they'd seen everything that she could do. And not without good reason, I suppose, given her persona that we'd seen in comedy shows and other things. She'd got this public persona.
Yeah, she'd got that public persona, but she'd also done Shakespeare and other things, which I, at the time I hadn't known nothing about.
No, only afterwards
I realised that she's a properly trained actress, and she's done these things where, you know, you just think, okay, Catherine Tate in the Shakespeare play. But now that's such a big draw that when her and David Tennant did a Shakespeare play, they were fully booked out all the way through their run because they wanted to go see these pair just bounce off each other like they were in the show, like they were on the stage. And I just think Catherine Tate as Donna Noble, brilliant. If you get to the classic, I do like Jamie. I have always loved Jamie, right? And this is a bit surprising in that I they actually watch many of his shows until I was well into my 20s, 30s, because...
As they came out on VHS.
I think as the earliest one was probably the Croutons, and I don't think there was much more after that because they did it on that Five Faces of Doctor Who.
That's right. That was my first sampling of any of that too.
So that was Five Faces of Doctor Who was your first...
Yeah, and that really... That was my first sampling of old Doctor Who, of not seeing just little black and white pictures in Doctor Who Weekly or Doctor Who magazine, of actually seeing these people walk and talk, and Jamie and Zoe, to be honest, because I think they are very much a double act throughout a lot of that. They both really stood out to me.
Jamie with Victoria. Okay, Victoria. Oh, dear me. Victoria, she would have been a great companion if she wasn't such a wimp. That's the word, yeah. Would he be a wimp? I don't know. Yeah, she wasn't the right companion for Jamie. Whereas with Zoe, she was the right companion for as a fellow companion with Jamie, in that they could bounce off. Because Zoe was more intelligent to be able to do things and Jamie would follow along, whereas Victoria wouldn't do things and Jamie would have to be the one that did the things and she'd follow along.
That's right. He was the big brother to her, really, wasn't he? Whereas with Zoe, it did feel like they were more of equals, and that Jamie kind of fancied her a little bit, and that she might have fancied him too. But
I'm not sure about the fancy. I thought Jamie would probably fancy Victoria more than he fancied Zoe. I think Zoe was more like a little sister, whereas from Zoe's
flipped my view.
Jamie was probably the annoying little child. So that's my way of thinking of them pair. Whereas with Victoria and Jamie, as the youngins say, they could have been shipped together.
So what is it about Jamie and Fraser Hines that's sort of kept him at the forefront of your mind? But in fact, you didn't grow up watching him. What do you think?
It's through the books. Jamie was in the books, and he was quite he was a fun character in the books, and I liked him. And then once you start getting into the storylines. The actual stories when I started watching them on VHS, him and Patrick Tate together were a great double act, and they really, really seemed to get on. Looked like they'd go on the show, and he'd follow him anywhere. And I really thought he was a superb character all the way through.
There's how can I put this? There's a similarity there between what Sylvester and Sophie did together, and the dynamic between Patrick and Fraser, I think. Almost a double act, and the way that they would throw things backwards and forwards between them. I don't know if Troughton and Hines had any influence over the script, if they would be playful and maybe ad-lib things or change things up. I'm not entirely sure, but I think there was that closeness was very similar.
They probably did manage to ad-lib things in rehearsal, and if they were good enough, they would probably put in the script. But other than that, I'm not sure how much room they'd have to work on the scripts to be able to put it into the final product. But them paired together, as I said, them paired together were excellent. It's just their nature together. You can see it in Tomb of the Cybermen. Tomb of the Cybermen, they're like a double act in that, but they're trying to look after Victoria. Some of the comedy moments in there just paid off. There's other bits all the way through the story. All the way through the stories that Jamie and the Doctor were a great combination. But I'm trying to think of anybody else. No, I can't really think. Sarah Jane, probably, and Joe Grant. But again, they were close to their own respective Doctors. Joe with Third Doctor, and I'd say Sarah Jane more with the Fourth.
I'm picking up a little bit from the things that you say that you would favour, because a lot of people, you know, there's a difference, isn't there, between people who favour the crowded TARDIS or those who think that the ideal thing is still one doctor, one companion? Have you got a preference?
I don't mind a crowded TARDIS at all, right? As long as they've got things to do. If they haven't got things to do, then it just gets annoying. And you just think, why have you got this crowded TARDIS in there and they haven't got things to do? You see them having to stand in the background, make finger shadow puppets sometimes. Right?
I don't know who you mean. I don't know
if they can work the script to be able to show each person can be split off and do their own things and it helps the storyline, then it's great. I do prefer... I mean, it worked quite well during the William Hartnell era and sort of in the Peter Davison era. But then they realised maybe going back to one companion per doctor is a lot better than they can split off the storyline, just have those two strands instead of having, like, if they've got like three companions trying to do different stuff.
And of course, during the Hartnell stories as well, you know, it was running by, for the most part, all year round. Some of the stories were 6 or 7 weeks, so they could split the action up like that, couldn't they? And sometimes you wouldn't see the Doctor or Susan or Vicky. They would disappear for a whole week and give people a week off.
Well, this is it. I mean, the Aztecs, Susan vanished for 2 episodes, and this is a 4-part story. She might have been there for film inserts, but she wasn't there in the studio. Them early years, of course, they needed a crowded TARDIS, not just to help the storylines, because they were filming us live, and they needed to have people in a different set to be able to cut from the one set straight to the other.
Oh, of course, yeah. But, I thought of it like that. So yeah, they would.
Them early years, they could do that. It's when they went to, I think, John Pertwee's era, they went back to one companion because they were filming all the scenes on one set, I think, and then breaking that down and going off to somewhere else. They could have like a proper studio recording instead of having to record it as a live studio play.
Quick question.
Go on.
Mashup time. If you could get two companions together that were never on screen together, who would you pair up?
You mean like them, like random photos they got in Day of the Doctor, where you got like Harry Sullivan meeting Sarah Kingdom and stuff?
Yeah, yeah. Little things like that.
Is it got like two companions?
I'm re-watching the two Doctors at the moment. You've got Perry with Jamie there, and I just think how much fun that is. If they did it with any two other companions, who do you think would have been good on screen together?
Well, Tegan, I'd love to have seen with somebody like Joe, right? Because Joe is a great little character, but she'd be basically eclipsed by Tegan Jovanka, right? I'd love to see Tegan with Joe. Also, Harry with Tegan would have been another one. Because Harry with Sarah Jane, actually, they'd be too similar, wouldn't they? Or would be the same as Tegan's, Harry and Sarah.
Tegan's got Sarah Jane's
DNA all the way through.
Turned up to about 10, yeah.
I can't really think. Mind you could just switch on any Big Finish audio play these days.
They've You'll got probably find it.
Yeah, they've got everybody teamed up with everybody. Right, so you could do things within audio as long as the actors are alive. I can't really
pick it out of a Tom Bowler.
Yeah, well, you could do. I can't really think of two companions that could go together.
I often think how much fun it would be to get somebody like, well, you were talking about Donna, and how much fun it would be to see her with somebody like Joe Grant, or particularly with Ian and Barbara. Big contrast of all those eras. I mean, particularly if Ian and Barbara were plucked out of the 60s.
Yeah.
And there, because Barbara was the representation of a modern woman in the early 60s, wasn't she? And I think that Donna Noble was the representation of a modern woman in the late noughties. And I think the contrast between them, between what makes them tick, what they want, what their goals are, ambitions in life, being a woman has changed so much in the time in between.
Well, you could say there's a lot changed. I mean, not a lot changed through the classic era as such, except towards when Ace came on board. Because it was still the female companion was in distress and the doctor would always be the one to help her out. The male companions could do whatever they wanted, but it was always a female companion that was in distress. In the New Who series, the female companion isn't always in distress. She's sometimes the one that comes to the rescue and has done a few times. I mean, it happened in the first episode with Chris Freckleston in Rose. Right, Rose was the one that's swinging through the chain to knock the vial into the Nestine's nesting consciousness.
Right. It was good that was there in week one as well, wasn't it? Because it's the way that they pair up and they become equals. They respect one another. They work as a team. It's like making that statement from week one.
Yeah, well, this is it. I think they realise they can't have a Doctor Who companion that was just going to be...
A damsel in distress.
Damsel in distress, well done. Yeah. Right, sorry. But yeah, a damsel in distress. And they needed a companion that could carry the storyline. And they had... And Russell T. Davies, bless him, managed to pick a character called... Made a character called Rose. That was also, that was helped in that first season by a fantastic actress, Billy Piper. If she didn't have Billy Piper in that role, I don't think it would have been as successful a show as it would have been. She needed to be able to be good enough to be able to bounce off Christopher Eccleston, and she was. She followed that through to be in the second season, and she did a good job with David Tennant. I mean, I know, I understand people calling it, they became a bit too smug, but that was their downfall towards the end anyway. If it wasn't for Billy Piper and the success of Billy Piper, right, I don't think it would have been as big a success as they would have been hoping.
It was lightning in a bottle in some respects, I think. I mean, people reacted quite badly, didn't they, to Billy Piper being cast?
Oh, yes, I remember.
Fans did. I don't think the general public did, but fans definitely did. And even though there's been plenty of straight acting from her in the 3 or 4 years leading up to that, there were examples there of how good she was going to be if you were willing to find them, yeah. I thought. But there's something about that character, and particularly with Christopher Eccleston, I agree, as much as I love her with David Tennant, that I think the purity in the relationship between those two in series one, it's less of a compromise somehow and less driven by a populist ideal of sort of getting them together. There's a certain romantic subtext to series one, maybe, but I don't think it's there.
You could say that Russell T. Davies based that on the Doctor, Seventh Doctor persona with Ace. If it hadn't been for them last 2-3 years, right, where they introduced Ace and she was like a modern girl, a modernish girl on an alien planet. She was basically a girl from a council estate, which is what Rose was, a girl from a council estate. But then he added the soap opera elements, Mickey and Jackie. And this sort of also helped people get in touch with the show because they were interested in these characters because of the soap opera elements. The
story, more ways of being able to relate to the characters and the situation and the places that they find themselves emotionally. I mean,
you got like Russell T. Davies has got a background in Coronation Street and soaps, and so he knew how to make a character interesting enough for the general public to be able to go, yeah, I don't want to know what happened with Mickey. It all comes to a head in them two. The one where Mickey comes back into Cardiff and they chase Boomtown, that was it. And you understand that Mickey has been hanging around for years, waiting for her to come back, and at the drop of a hat, he just comes straight for her. This is a soap opera element.
Yeah, even though he started a new relationship at that point, he pretty much drops it just on the off chance of getting together and being in the company of Rose. I think you're right. I think it's a natural extension of what was done in the latter part of the classic run. And I think that, you know, we did find out a certain amount about Ace, but most of it was what we were told. We were never, I know it's, that's become a cliche now, you know, show us, don't tell us, yeah. And, you know, all that sort of thing. But it was true in that respect. You know, she would talk about her parents, talk about her upbringing. And of course, we did go back there in that final story, but it still mostly happened off screen, whereas the potency, I think people want more in the 21st century from their characters, and Doctor Who, modern Doctor Who's in a better place to revisit and explore in that sort of broadened way. I mean, people use expressions like soap opera in regard to it, and I always tell them off. I think it's I don't necessarily think it's soap. I think it's just character drama, because there's nothing superficial about it, whereas soap obviously it's that totally analog, never-ending narrative that just stretches on and on and on. There's a literacy to the arcs of characters in Russell T. Davies' Doctor Who.
So you can tell me off about calling it a soap opera, but
I was going to tell you off because I could tell the context that you were saying it was slightly different.
But it's a soap opera element that did help that first two seasons of Doctor Who,
Because, it's a shorthand. What you're saying is it's the viewer's shorthand, so they will recognise the way that it was shot.
Yeah, but it's also the fact that returning characters, recurring characters came back in, right? And they would follow, they'd go, oh, yeah, that's Mickey. He didn't want to travel with the Doctor, right? Now he's come back. Or Jackie, she's now finding other things to do while waiting for her daughter to come back. It's all these bits that have happened. Again, as you said, they were telling. These were actually showing. They did show them in like Love and Monsters, what Jackie was doing while Billy Pipe Rose was out off track, traveling around the universe.
Showed her getting on with her life and how she sort of, as she sort of marks her time really, and what she thinks of in the absence of her daughter. Yeah. Moving on a little and talking about Love and Monsters.
Fantastic episode. Before you carry on, before you say anything, I think that's a great episode. Right, and if you're about to say something negative about it, I would have switched it off.
I wasn't. I wasn't actually. I was saying you've talked about the love.
Yeah.
And now we're going to go on to talk about the monsters.
Oh, it was a segue.
This isn't my first barbecue, you know?
I forgot that you're professional like this. Damn.
Because you know, many have argued the case time and time again, haven't they, that the true co-stars of Doctor Who aren't the companions at all. It is the monsters and the creatures. And I was wondering, because of what you were talking about earlier on, as host of the Take Your Seats podcast, for example, and all those genre films that you talk about, did your love of movies start with Doctor Who and a love of genre movies and like creature features and things like that? You know, are they linked somehow, and does it come from the nightmares of Doctor Who and these creatures?
No, I don't think so. I'm pretty sure I was watching movies before, sci-fi movies before Doctor Who had come out. I started watching Doctor Who regularly. Right, so now I don't think they were linked.
Because usually it's like a gateway drug, isn't it, Doctor Who? Yeah, but it was for me.
But I probably have in recent years with Take Your Seats podcast been able to get in touch with Doctor Who fans so they can tell me about their favourite sci-fi movies. But I think during my formative years, I was watching movies, but it's mainly comedy, and it wasn't sci-fi, apart from Star Wars. It was mainly comedy ones that I was watching. So I don't think I was that informed through Doctor Who as to watching sci-fi movies. What about you? Hold on, what about you? Are you saying is that what happened with you?
Oh, absolutely. When I said in the little intro there, I say it all started with Doctor Who for me. That's no exaggeration. Absolutely everything. Hiding from the monsters, all the cliches. It led from Doctor Who directly into stuff like, you know, getting John Carpenter's The Thing on VHS, for example, and recognising, not knowing that they'd pinched Seeds of Doom from that, but recognising the creature feature angle from both factors has its origins in 1950s, I suppose you could say, in B-movies or in Hammer movies, that sort of thing, and the way that popular culture, you can sort of track it back through the decades, that the people who were making the stuff in the 70s and 80s had all watched the same things 10, 20 years before.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it very much pulled me in like that. And so, particularly going through the 80s with the Amblin era of movies, got to come back to John Carpenter all the time, but it's there with so many sci-fi and horror movies that I would relate to it to Doctor Who in some way. Have you got a favourite monster? Is that not really what you go into Doctor Who for?
My favourite monster has always been the Cybermen, but I just like the look of them. The original, Peter Davison versions. I mean, they look a bit flabby in their suits. Right, and then you don't look as proper Cybermen, which I think were the proper Cybermen would be the late 60s ones during the Patrick Troughton era. They were proper Cybermen. But I did like the really shiny versions of the David Banks era, where he would be the cyber leader, and I liked him. And that's why my Twitter handle has always been Cybermen. Right, it's gone through various iterations, but it always goes back to Cybermen. And then when they came back in the Capaldi final episode of his season, two episodes, I was so happy because they were the proper cloth-covered faces. The hands was showing. They were proper human beings that had been changed into Cybermen. And that just brought back so many great memories, I'd say.
They did. In that two-parter, yeah, I think with the... Because it's obviously that's about 3 years old, two to three years old now. So the dust has settled a little on it. They were very successful at tuning right back into the core idea of what the Cybermen were there, weren't they? Because I think Moffat had used the Cybermen quite a lot. I think people had become very used to them and had forgotten what they were supposed to be and what the anchor of their appeal was.
Well, as she says, Moffat had been Moffat and Russell T. Davies, really, towards the end, right? They were using Cybermen, but they weren't Cybermen as such. They'd just become robots.
Robotic soldiers.
Yeah, they were just, as she says, robotic soldiers. They're just walking up and down, clump, 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 right? And you're just thinking, this is just a generic monster. When he brought them back as these pained creatures in these cloth-covered coveralls with little big massive chest units and everything, and your real live hands, and it just brought the creepy nature of what these actual creatures were. And to be able to use what was the name of the actress,
Pearl Mackie,
what was her character, Bill Potts, yeah, Bill Potts, as when she got changed into a Cyberman, sorry guys, spoilers, but she got changed into a Cyberman, and you could see the way she was sort of reacting when she discovered she was a Cyberman. And I think that's the way...
That mental anguish as well as the physical pain was really... It got under your skin, didn't it?
But then you also go back... you could, if you add an emotion, right, so that emotion that shouldn't have really been used with the Cybermen, it was love, and they used it with James Corden's character in that, not The Lodger, the Closing Time. And they used it in that, where his love for his child forced him to reject the cyber conversion. Right? And I think that should not have been used. Any emotion should have just been wiped out straight away, right? You can't have love that reverse a cyber conversion, and that was one of the things I did not like about some of the Cybermen stories, where Yvonne Hartman did the same. She somehow controlled her emotions enough to be able to help the Doctor, and I was thinking, no, she would have been totally converted.
It did seem to be something they would continue. It's one thing to sort of bend that rule once, but it did get to the point where every time the Cybermen turned up and the stakes were on that scale, they would bend it every time to the point where it lost its power. But yeah, you're right. And I think a lot of people rejected that second appearance with the Craig character, particularly because of that.
Yeah. I mean, that first episode, The Lodger, great. I love that Lodger, actually. I think it's great. It got its flaws. But coming back to his character in the second one, he just got spoiled with that, the ending where the love... changed the cyber conversion, refused the cyber conversion for his character. And I thought, okay, I'm hoping with the new series, the Cybermen, because if you've seen the trailer and the Cybermen, the Cybermen are in that trailer and they look really creepy. The slightly battered one that was in the trailer, and I think that would be great. I mean, the only other time that it's been scary like that was the one that chased Rory when he was guarding Amy in the Pandorica opens.
It was in sort of pieces, skulking around the floor, wasn't it?
And that,
so chasing him.
That was a scary Cyberman. But that's the only time I found Cyberman scary in New Who.
Just to clarify, because as we're recording this, we've seen two trailers for Series 12 of Doctor Who. And yeah, as Sookie's just said, the Cybermen, or a Cyberman, has appeared. Out of a sort of smoky, fiery mess, whatever's going on there, cutting a very kind of brutalistic shape, I think. And what we were just talking about, the last time that we saw the Cybermen properly was in that two-part with Peter Capaldi, and because they were so successful in tuning back in to that body horror and that nightmarish idea of the cyber race, how to follow that, I think following that is a lot harder than following what had been done with the Daleks. Yeah, maybe that's why they've held on to it for a little longer. I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's what, as you said, it's been 3 years since that last episode aired. Yeah. Right, so let's hope they'll come back with a great storyline to continue that great storyline that they had from that last Cyberman story.
And just think, we never got to see James Corden converted into a Cyberman. I know plenty of people who would have been upset just by that. before we move on, if do you cosplay, Sookie? And if you could cosplay one Doctor Who monster, what would it be?
I've not exactly cosplayed, but I've been inside Daleks for events in the past. When Rick used to do events at the NEC, and at we did a couple of live TV shows for a live TV, I think it was.
You say inside, did you say you just sat inside on, or did you get to operate?
No, I got to operate. So it was, if I remember, it was Nigel Pearson used to have a few Cybermen costumes and some Dalek props, and you could, what we go to the Walls of Fenric as a group would go to the NEC to recruit members, and to be able to get members or to get people to come over to you, you'd have the costumes around, so a couple of us would jump in the costumes, and I used to love jumping in the Dalek costume, Dalek prop, and I'd walk up and down the NEC hall. And you'd have the kids coming up. Oh, look, fantastic, great, fantastic. And the parents would all be going pointing. But the best bits was always when you just walk up to somebody, stand still. Don't let them know that they turn around and go, oh, look. They think they're looking at just a prop. And then all of a sudden you just move the arm, right, and they would freak out, right? They would just jump out of their skin, and they'd be halfway down the road by the time of the... Because for some reason, Daleks are still scary memories for some of these people. And having a live, moving Dalek in front of you, right, would freak some of these people out. But yeah, I've been in Dalek props for events for Wars of Fenric. I've not really done any cosplay. I mean, I'm not sure I'd be confident enough to be able to turn up in any of the costumes for it. Can you see?
Some people are so brave, aren't they?
I can't see myself as a fully bearded, I don't know, doctor, right? I can't see a costume that would fit with a beard.
Yeah, well, the war doctor, you could say
the war doctor. What about him? Yeah, well done. Dan,
after a particular length of
time. I still haven't got the confidence, man. What have you cosplayed?
I haven't, no, but I have owned several, two scarves over the years, which for a long time, that was really all you needed, wasn't it? A scarf.
I've actually got in the garage downstairs. I've got a scarf that was, I think, about 3 feet long. And then over the years, right, it's sort of unraveled, right? So my missus and my mum over the years have just gone round, got other scarves, and they've just added bits to it.
And I'm like a patchwork.
So it's gone from about 3 feet to about 7 or 8 feet, right? So that sometimes gone wrapped around me when it's got cold, and I've gone walking out with that, and that looks like a Tom Baker scarf. Actually, I'm just wondering now if I've still got that scarf, because I'm pretty sure the missus is just on a clearer.
You could make your own doctor, part war doctor, part Tom Baker. This is the beauty of it, isn't it?
You can do whatever you like with these sort of mix and mash costumes that you go around. I mean, the new Who stuff, right? You just need a leather jacket for Christopher Eccleston. Just need a suit so that you be nice and tight fitting for David Tennant. A tweed jacket and a bow tie for Matt Smith.
Yeah.
And Capaldi, just find yourself a frilly shirt or jacket, whatever it is. He was wearing a hoodie.
I did go to a 40th birthday party a couple of years ago. A friend of mine's wife, I went to a 40th birthday party. I thought I was going as Matt Smith. I put the waistcoat and the bow tie on and all that sort of stuff. And people just thought I was Ronnie O'Sullivan. They thought I turned up as a snooker player. So that sort of bounced back a little bit on me. Yeah. So I'd got the Sonic, but
what was the colour of the waistcoat?
It was black.
Well, there you go. you had to get yourself a tweed waistcoat.
Yeah, this is it. Yeah, I tried to cut costs, you see, so it sort of got lost in translation. I thought if I just waved the Sonic around a little bit, the people would get it, but no. People used to ask me to pass the chalk and all sorts of stuff. I know, the experiences that we have.
I have got, just before you carry on, I've just realised I've got a Doctor Who bathrobe, which is quite nice. It's quite soft. It's lovely. And it's got like a hood as well. And I have on a couple of occasions, I've gone past when I've had a shower, like I've had the bathrobe on, and I've gone past the mirror. And because I've had the hood up and all you can see is the beard, I just do look like a Jedi Knight, but in a Doctor Who costume. All right. And I think that I could do that if I ever wanted to cosplay a Star Wars Doctor Who crossover.
Yeah. A Time Knight. Time. A mixture of a Jedi and a Time Lord.
Yes, I could do it. Jedi Lord.
You could be the very, very first Time Knight or Jedi Lord. Probably, yeah, you heard it here first, everybody.
Yeah, or I'm just thinking the other one was, I might end up looking like Gandalf.
Yeah. Well, you have inadvertently done my next segue for me, you see, because I was going to ask you about this, about the fact that as Doctor Who fans, we are either the easiest people in the world to buy for or the hardest people in the world to buy for, because obviously we collect anything with Doctor Who on it or whatever. But then again, there's always the chance that people buy us stuff and we've already got it. You know, so it depends on who you speak to. But are you a collector, was what I wanted to ask you. And do you have any favourites or most treasured pieces of merchandise, are either official or unofficial to do with Doctor Who, that you treasure more than any other?
Well, we're recording right now, and it's on video. There's a video recording happening. And as you can see over my shoulder, Dan can see over my shoulder. Nobody else, I'm sorry. But Dan can see over my shoulder.
Sookie is dwarfed by a collection of Doctor Who.
There's a Doctor Who video collection right behind me. And I'm just making a little noise there. But that is not my prized possession. My prized possession is in the other room, actually. It's Doctor Who Celebration, the Peter Haining book that came out in
1983.
This is a book I've picked up. When that book came out, I used to go to the library every day and I used to read it. I'd then take it out. And what had happened was that I was taking it out every 3-4 weeks. And then it was taken out every time I would go to the library. So I was basically booking it back in, taking it back.
So the card in the inside cover, all it had got on every date was your name next to it.
Well, it had the date on there. Like it would have, my card would permanently.
Or your number.
Yeah, my card would permanently be with the Peter Haming book thing. And
these were hardback books, weren't they, Sookie? They were made by W.H. Allen, who also owned Target.
Yeah.
Very sort of outsized hardback books, quite lavish.
These coffee,
full of photographs.
Coffee style books.
Coffee books. That's it. That's the right. Table style.
Yeah. And so I'd have this book, and I think I must have taken this book out for nearly 2 years. Now, the ladies occasionally in the library would stop me taking it out, which, okay, I understood that, but when a different lady would be on there, I'd take it back out again. And so I was constantly borrowing this book. And I used to, don't do this, kids, but I used to make notes in the back. Right, so there's a list of all the stories in there and I'd put, and he'd have like the director, writer, whatever. And then I'd add little notes to it, like who novelised it, when was the year.
Do you realise that Bilston Library have probably... They've probably been looking for the culprit of this.
No, they ain't looking for it because I actually bought that book, right? Because that was going to be why that is my prized possession. Because after...
That same copy?
That same copy. Right, so after about nearly 10 years of this book on and off maybe coming into my possession at the library, whatever, it suddenly appeared on the for sale bookshelf. And I think it was 25p, 50p or something. And, you know, for a hardback copy like that, 25p, 50p. All right.
That's not your bus fare to get there.
Yeah, well, I didn't even have to have... I only lived down the road. Right, so I could just walk up. And I walked up. I saw it there. I think, they can't sell this. Hold on. Of course they can sell this. I'm going to buy this book. It's my book. And I bought that book. And I've had that now ever since. And that is my prized possession. I've got autographs and books. I've got... stuff that's been autographed by people, DVD covers, video covers, books, postcards, I've got all that. But that, because it's got so much memory for me, right, that is my most prized possession. If I went out and tried to sell it, people go, somebody's written in this. It's not worth anything. Who wants this? I'll give you 25p for it, what I paid for it. So, yeah, to me.
Is the price sticker still on it? Is the 25p label still on it?
I'm pretty sure there's a stamp in there. Wolverhampton Public Libraries selling this book has been sold. So there's probably.
If I ask Sookie nicely, he might take a photograph of that book and we can put it on the Instagram feed.
Yeah, I'll try and find it.
What was the last piece of Doctor Who merchandise that you bought, including books?
The last piece of merchandise is right above my head, and it's season 10 Doctor Who collection. Right.
Oh, on DVD, Blu-ray, that kind.
Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Series 10 on the collection. So that's the last piece. I mean, I stopped buying
You didn't get that at the library as well, did you? That was Amazon.
That was a proper... I mean, you ain't going to get that in the library, are you?
Right. Oh, they've got it at my local library. They rent out DVDs and Blu-rays now.
Well, have they got the collection?
I don't think they have.
No. They wouldn't have the collection, would they? I don't think.
No, I haven't thought to us.
Go find out if they've got Series 10. And if you find Series 10, just say, look, you know, I'm sure it's only worth a couple of quid. Who wants to watch this? Right? And you might be able to get it off them with a stamp saying £2.
That's it. Employ some psychology and maybe get it at a knockdown price. It's time we had a short break. Type 40 is part of the Fandom Podcast Network, as I'm reminding people. Maybe you've heard some of those shows on the feed, some of our other shows. If so, you certainly have seen some of the eye-catching logos and designs there. And you can get all of these logos on T-shirts, mugs, hats, and a whole range of merch at our TeePublic store. You can search for the Fandom Podcast Network at TeePublic. There's a storefront, and you can have a browse and admire and wear the team colours of whatever shows are your favourites. One of these shows that my friend is now coming along to tell you about. Check it all out.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. We'd like to continue to feed your ears by inviting you to listen to our other awesome shows on the Fandom Podcast Network. It starts with our flagship show, Culture Clash, a weekly pop culture podcast. For you movie fans, we have Couch Potato Theater, where we celebrate our favorite cult classic and guilty pleasure movies. We also have Time Warp. That's our fandom flashback show, where we like to look back on our favorite fandoms. For you NFL fans, we have the End Zone podcast. And of course, for you Alfred Hitchcock fans, please check out Good Evening. For you Star Trek and Orville fans, we also have the Union Federation podcast. And for you hard rock metal fans, we have Hair Metal, the 1980s rock metal podcast. Doctor Who fans, we've got one for you as well. We have Type 40, our Doctor Who podcast. If you're a fan of 1980s action films, please check out Lethal Mullet. And our newest show, we have a Star Wars podcast called What a Piece of Junk. You can enjoy all of these great Fandom Podcast Network shows on our master feed at fpnet.podbean.com. The FPNet can also be found on the Podbean app. The Fandom Podcast Network can also be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Please search on Facebook for Fandom Podcast Network. You can also email us at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. We are also on Instagram and Twitter under Fandom Podcast Network. Thank you for listening, and remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.
There's something for everybody there on the Fandom Podcast Network master feed. As a Doctor Who fan, of course, Suki, my favourite of all those shows has to be the Time Warp, where Kevin, Erin and Kyle, they've just had a trip up and down the time vortex to focus on movie scores and soundtracks, unforgettable movie theme tunes from yesterday. So that's probably right up your street as well with the Take Your Seats stuff.
Okay. How many times I have to tell you, Dan?
You don't even like movie music.
I can listen to movie music and I'll go, yeah, I recognise that. I recognise that from that movie. I recognise that theme. Right, great. But after that, it's okay. What am I supposed to be listening to? I'm sure they would love to be able to come on and talk about music and stuff like that. You're talking to the wrong guy.
With Doctor Who and that sort of the musical aspect to Doctor Who, the theme tune and all that sort of thing, if it doesn't spark an interest in, well, I suppose in music or whatever else, has it sparked a creativity in you? Are you a very creative man? Because you do find that a lot with Doctor Who fans.
I've written for fanzines in the past, and I've written for couple of charity books and done the odd thing here and there where I've written a couple of things for radio. But other than that, I just ain't got the time. I mean, the kids have all been growing up and the job has been getting in the way. So the creativity is now being channeled basically through the podcasts, which is great because all I have to do is watch a story or a movie a couple of times and then talk about it afterwards. And that's my creativity these days. It's just channeled through the podcasts.
It seems to me that Doctor Who, we talked earlier on about you going to the library, you being the scourge of the local library. Did Doctor Who have a big impact on your reading as a child? Did it raise your reading level? Yeah. And have you kept that going throughout later life? Are you a big reader still now?
No. The thing with Doctor Who at an early age was that once I started reading Doctor Who books, I wanted to read other Terence Dicks books, and that sort of led on to reading other authors. I didn't read much of the classics like War of the Worlds or anything like that. It's just the popular books at the time. And I've carried on reading up until, I think, the last Harry Potter book came out. Then after that, I just stopped. I've not really read that much. And this is a problem as well with, say, Doctor Who magazine. I was getting Doctor Who magazine weekly a year into its run. And I've been collecting it all the way through. And then about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, I says, I can't afford to keep buying this magazine because I wasn't reading it. I might read an article or the news, but I was basically paying £6 for a magazine that I wasn't reading. And
this is a common theme with people that come on the show. I hear this a lot, that people have stopped getting the magazine lately. For a number of reasons.
Yeah, well, mine was just that I wasn't reading it. They've probably got so many interesting articles in there. And the interviews were probably great, but other things were getting in my way. So the magazine would be put to one side and I'll get around to watching it. And then a month had gone by and there's a new magazine. So you go out and buy that one. And then you'd put it to one side thinking, I'll get around to reading something in there. Might read one article, put it to one side. Next thing you know, there's another magazine on the table.
That's it. You think, I'll get round to that next week, and then you see another one in WH Smith's or whatever.
So I was like 7 or 8 months behind on the magazines. The books as well, why they suddenly stopped is because I do like watching TV and movies. And if I start watching TV, I'm not exactly going to be reading a book. And I've got so many TV shows on the go. And I'll end up watching a TV show instead of reading a book. And I think that's wrong to me. I should really be reading more. But for some reason, I just haven't got around to... The lifestyle I lead does not make me want to read a book.
It doesn't lend itself to you doing that in your free time. It's a very similar story with me. I was such a keen reader as a child. I loved it. I got two or three. Like you talk about your DVDs that are behind you. I'd got shelves and shelves of books. Like when the VHS market boomed and then the DVDs and things, films and TV have sort of become, they've replaced that for me. And I say that all the time. What you've just said, I really should read more. And I think I've been repeating that phrase for so long. I think, do I really mean that? Do I really need to read more?
See, I've got, like, when I get to work, I've got like a half an hour break or sometimes a 45-minute break or an hour break, whatever. Because I've got TV shows. I've got some of the TV shows on my phone, like iPlayer or Netflix or whatever, and I'll just bang that on my break. And it's there.
Escapism.
Yeah, and it's just there. I could sit there and watch that. And I don't have to worry about reading the book or keeping a mark. I'll just watch a whole episode in one go, and then that's the end of my break. Carry on with my work.
You've shared a lot in the last hour or so about your own personal connection with Doctor Who and day-to-day life, work, rest and play. But what's your warmest overriding memory connected with Doctor Who, either as a fan and through your fandom and life sharing with other fans, really, or just of the show itself, just of watching the show itself? Have you got
There's so many different memories that you could go around going back into your past and thinking that's a great memory. I mean, watching the Five Doctors and Children in Need Night, great memory, just sitting there with the whole family. I mean, they probably were
forgettable night. Yeah.
The rest of my family were probably interested. I was the only one there sitting there watching it all. And then going to the Walls of Fenric meeting like-minded people, getting to know Roger. Roger has been one of my best friends for the last 30 years nearly, and he's been fantastic, right? And I've got to know him well. Then there's also going to events, when they were showing Day of the Doctor at the cinemas. All right, you go in there and you see all these people. Because I hadn't been to a Doctor Who convention for a number of years, and then well before knew who had started. And then when I came to the Day of the Doctor, there was all these people in fezzes, bow ties, the actual suit, David Tennant suits. They were all wearing long scarves. They're walking around with sonic screwdrivers. And so many, and that the auditorium for that cinema was full, absolutely full.
And it's the same when I went to see it too.
Yeah. So you just knew you were part of a community. And then also then getting to know podcasting, in that I used to follow people who used to do the podcast, listen to them all the while. Once I started getting into that and really listening to loads of podcasts and wanting to do podcasting, and then getting through the guys, getting to know them, I managed to get into podcasting with the Proctor Who boys, and they have been fantastic. If it hadn't been for Bob, Craig, Mark, and to later on John, I don't think I'd have probably carried on a lot of this podcast. Oh, actually, Mark Cochran as well. Mark's been brilliant as well. The Human Palindrome, he's called on Twitter. So if you check him out.
The Human Palindrome.
And he's got I'm going to give a shout out to him as well. And he's got a podcast himself called Nerdology Podcast. He just does geeky stuff on there. He just gets...
Oh, I've seen Nerdology. Yeah. It's a good show, though.
I went on to his podcast. And this is some like six years ago, 2014. And he then started Nerdology. And he says, do you fancy coming on? I says, yeah. Thinking I'll be doing a Doctor Who thing. Right. He says, no, I want you to do Band of Brothers. You mean the World War II drama? He says, yeah. Right. So I says, okay. But I haven't seen this in 20 years, 10, 15 years, or however long he was on. He says, yeah, no worries. Just come on and talk about it. So I blitzed it within a week, all 10 episodes. Maybe now it's got ready, thinking it's just going to be me and him. And then he came on with another lady, a lady who watches Band of Brothers every week, or an episode every week, or every month.
Oh, she's like, she knows every line.
She was up to date on everything, as in she knew things I wouldn't know. So I'm there sort of drowning in this sea of knowledge. And she was just telling me things, and I'll pipe in and go, yeah, to the best of my knowledge, this. And then she'd go, yeah, but this is what happened there. And I think, okay, I got the bug with that, and then just carried on going. That's been my way, basically just carrying on with Doctor Who fandom and so on.
So what you're saying is that you're still loving it. You're still living your warmest memory.
Well, yeah, yes, I am, because I'm enjoying the podcast community and getting to know these people. And we have a different guest on every week. And so you're getting different guests on from all over the world. Like you do for your podcast, you get a different guest on from all over the world. You get to talk to them. More often than not, their experiences are exactly the same as your experiences. They might only be from down the road at Dudley, or they might be in Tasmania, right? Just their experiences always seem to be the same. Occasionally, you'll find something that's totally different, but more often than not, these are people are so familiar to, because they've gone through the same sort of processes that you have into becoming a Doctor Who fan.
Yeah, and now we can unite like this and drive the rest of the world mad with our...
Well, we've tried uniting and making the rest of the world mad on our Proctor Who podcast, and most people just go, oh, just put the music on, carry on.
Quickly, one last thing. It's what we call the lightning pick. Someone comes up to you. They've never seen Doctor Who, never even heard of it, which I know that seems unlikely, but stick with me. So they come up to you and they have this conversation, and they ask you, as Mr. Doctor Who, as the go-to guy, what's the best sampler? Where's the ideal place to start on just one DVD? What disc would you hand them and why?
What disc would I hand them? I'd hand them... there's quite a few choices you could make on this alone. If you hand them Five Doctors, there's loads of history. It's just it's a warm glow for me. You hand them Day of the Doctor, again, it's a warm glow for me, but then why not get some of the history? But I'd hand them basically Terror of the Zygons. I think that's a great little story. It has a little bit of history with the uni. It's got great monsters in. It has some crappy flipping slow motion action in there. Not slow motion, animation in there.
There's always that one scene in there, in a lot of Doctor Who stories. Just ignore the rat.
Yeah, the Scarrison in there. But I'd hand them Terror of the Zygons. But there's quite a few stories from the Tom Baker's early year you could hand up.
No, I think Terror of the Zygons is a really good, solid choice. There's the horror. Yeah. There's the science fiction. There's that slight air of whimsy. There's the mysterious side to the Doctor. You've got two great companions, and yeah, lots of Doctor Who iconography. Strange enough, in the broadcast version, you don't see the TARDIS at all in Terror of the Zygons, do you? But other than that, I think it ticks pretty much every box.
It does. Yeah, you're right there. Doesn't show? No, it's Invisible TARDIS, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, because the missing scene turned up recently, didn't it? I think they put it on the DVD. Wasn't it the last DVD they ever released?
I don't know. I'll take your word for it. See, what I do with sometimes with my DVD collection is that I don't usually open them. Is that I've bought them and there's still some of these are still fully cellophane wrapped.
I think a couple of mine. I can't think of it, particularly when they re-released some special editions. Yeah, a couple of those.
Because you've watched them over the years and you've got them on VHS, you've got them, and you just remember, so you don't bother opening them. I am now doing that with the Blu-rays, in that the Blu-rays, they've all been opened, whereas before I would have probably just kept them sealed. But because of this, there's loads of people raving about the extra content on there, the stuff that's on there, you just think, okay, I've got to watch that. I've got to watch that. So that's the only time. I mean, did you ever buy season 10, series 10?
Yes, I've got season 10. Funnily enough, I haven't opened my season 10 now you mention it. No, I haven't. But I have opened season 23 because I'm like that as well. I don't open them, unless I'm going to immediately watch them. But you're right with these Blu-ray sets. I think with all this VAM that I know people who aren't watching the episodes, or at least for the time being, who are opening the sets and devouring all the extra content before everything else.
Yeah, I mean,
so it's certainly something I would do.
I think a couple of my co-hosts, they're doing exactly the same. They've opened up the box sets themselves, but they haven't watched the episodes. They're just watching all the added material.
Now, I will watch all the episodes, don't get me wrong. I watched every second of season 19, sorry, you know, and from that I went on and watched all the Peter Davison ones after that, and I was just waiting for the Blu-rays to come out. We'll see what happens then. But yeah, that's the beauty of having a collection, having Doctor Who on tap. You can just dip in and dip out, or do a binge watch of all the 70s, all the 60s, all the Dalek stories or whatever. And there might be some that you don't get around to seeing for 3 or 4 years, but it's just knowing that they're there and that you have the best possible available version.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, now that BritBox is coming out, and or has come out, but they're going to be putting on all the Doctor Who episodes of Boxing Day. You just think, would I go upstairs, pull down a DVD Blu-ray, right? Or would I just go and spend $5.99 for the convenience of just pressing a few buttons on your remote control and watching on the big telly without messing around with discs and stuff?
Let's hope that the thing that's going on with BritBox and it being included in all that will make lots of new fans, and this will be a kind of gateway for them to the point where they'll start with BritBox and then they'll want to own their own bits of plastic.
I'm not sure.
I doubt it.
I don't think that's the way the BBC are seen to be, yeah. Or BBC United.
Times are changing, aren't they, Sookie? We may well be yesterday's men here.
Well, I think the way they seem to be cutting back on the DVDs, because I'm pretty sure there's loads of stuff that they've just just been showing, but haven't been released on DVD these days. They're leaving it on iPlayer, right? People are having to watch it on iPlayer, and now BritBox is coming out. They're going to probably put it all on BritBox in a couple of years' time. Right? So I think, as you said, times are changing. Streaming is the thing. It's only us Doctor Who fans who seem to be still buying the DVDs, Blu-rays, whereas a lot of other people seem to be going towards streaming. I've still got all my DVDs. I've still got my Blu-rays. I've actually still also got all my VHSs. Right, so I have
as well.
Well, you mean so alike then, you know, man. And I've still got copies of my VHS off-air copies of, I think, at least the last 3 years of Sylvester McCoy. And I also have a Colin Baker, final Colin Baker season. But the only problem I've got there is I've got no VHS recorder or player. Right, so I've got no video player to be able to play any of that stuff on. But I've still got all the actual collection that I've still in my other room there.
That's probably a segue into a future show about the VHS tapes, I think. Sookie, it's been fantastic getting to know you over the last however long, and as you say, finding out these, in many ways, we are quite similar. I think there are certain fixed points in our fandoms that are strangely the same.
Yes.
it's very, very strange. Yeah, so thanks for joining me, and it's been great, genuine. It's been great to hear that enthusiasm. I know you say you're not the cheerful one, but you are really, really passionate and really enthusiastic about Doctor Who, and that's what comes over. And lots of good humour and this willingness to share and to connect with people. You know, it's one of the things that I've liked about hearing your content, and one of the reasons why I was delighted that you agreed to come speak to me.
Oh.
So, yeah, we'll be talking again, won't we, in the not so distant future?
Yes.
Although maybe in another galaxy far, far away.
No, I've changed my mind. You ain't coming on.
But I will be back, despite what's against. I will be back for more Type 40, though, very, very soon. So if you look out for that wherever you found this, it could have been on Apple Podcasts. It's the new name for iTunes. Please search for the Fandom Podcast Network on Apple Podcasts. Drop us a review there. And it's not just for our egos. It's so that new listeners can find us potentially too, you know, particularly if you leave us a 5-star review. That would be terrific. It's not expected, but it's always appreciated. Maybe you found us on the Podbean app, on Stitcher, Google Play, or Spotify. Spotify, so easy to use, and we're really easy to find. You can just search for the Fandom Podcast Network Masterfeed. You'll see the listings for Type 14, all the other shows there, dropping down your screen. It's a wonderful thing to behold. If you're feeling brave, you can contact any of us directly if you wish. Email type40doctorwho@gmail.com. There's our Facebook page and that Type 40 Facebook group. If you drop that into the search field, we'll just pop up. You can get that extra dimensional chit chat with us in real time. Suki, drop us a couple of those links again, would you?
Right. You can follow us on Twitter on Take Your Seats P. You can follow me personally on Twitter on Sideman_151. The Proctor Who feed has a Twitter as well, and that's just Proctor Who. But most of our content is on the Proctor Who Facebook page. If you could just go onto Facebook and just search for Proctor Who.
So simple. Thanks again for coming in. And as this is a time machine, the good news is I can drop you pretty much anywhere you need to go. So where's it going to be in all of time and space? Where do you want dropping off?
I need to go to Tatooine because I'm about to record a podcast. So do you mind dropping me off there?
There you go, Tatooine. That's the sandy one, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's the one.
Yeah, take my advice. Always shoot first. And
that's just terrible. But carry on.
Thanks again, Suki, and thank you for listening. Join us again next time here on the Fandom Podcast Network for another episode of Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast where we always have the time if you have the space.